Joshua chapter 11.
And it came to pass when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard these things that he sent to Jobab, king of Madon, to the king of Shimron, to the king of Arkshaph, and to the kings who were from the north, in the mountains, in the plain south of Shinaroth, in the lowland, and in the heights of Dor, on the west, to the Canaanites, in the east and in the west, the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Jebusite, in the mountains, and the Hivite, below Hermon, in the land of Mizpah. So they went out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand that is on the seashore in multitude, with very many horses and chariots. And when all these kings had met together, they came and camped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. But the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid because of them, for tomorrow about this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire." So Joshua and all the people of war with him came against them suddenly by the waters of Merom, and they attacked them. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel, who defeated them and chased them to Greater Sidon, to the brook Mizrephath, and to the valley of Mizpah eastward. They attacked them until they left none of them remaining. So Joshua did to them as the Lord had told him. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots with fire. Joshua turned back at the time and took Hazor and struck its king with the sword. For Hazor was formerly the head of all those kingdoms. And they struck all the people who were in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was none left breathing. Then he burned Hazor with fire. So all the cities of those kings and all their kings Joshua took and struck with the edge of the sword. He utterly destroyed them, as Moses the servant of the Lord had commanded. But as for the cities that stood on their mounds, Israel burned none of them, except Hazor only, which Joshua burned. And all the spoil of these cities and the livestock the children of Israel took as booty for themselves. But they struck every man with the edge of the sword until they had destroyed them, and they left none breathing. As the Lord had commanded Moses, his servant, so Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses. 16. Thus Joshua took all this land, the mountain country, all the south, all the land of Goshen, the lowland, and the Jordan plain, the mountains of Israel, and its lowlands, from Mount Halak and the ascent to Seir, even as far as Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon below Mount Hermon. He captured all their kings and struck them down and killed them. Joshua made war a long time with all those kings. There was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel, except the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. All the others they took in battle. For it was of the Lord to harden their hearts, that they should come against Israel in battle, that he might utterly destroy them, and that they might receive no mercy, but that he might destroy them as the Lord had commanded Moses. And at that time Joshua came and cut off the Anakim from the mountains, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, from all the mountains of Judah, and from all the mountains of Israel. Joshua utterly destroyed them with their cities. None of the Anakim were left in the land of the children of Israel. They remained only in Gaza, in Gath, and in Ashdod. So Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had said to Moses, and Joshua gave it as an inheritance to Israel, according to their divisions, by their tribes. Then the land rested from war.
Thank you, David. Appreciate that. Reading chapter 11 for us of Joshua. Before I begin the comments or section, do you have any questions? Anybody have any questions or comments about this? To the contrary, yes.
What exactly is hamstringing the horses?
Tying them together.
Cutting the back tendon off the leg.
Cutting the back tendon off the leg.
Isn't that a noisy thing?
A what?
Isn't that, wouldn't that be noisy? I mean, is that part of the sneaking up and cutting them off of all the horses?
No, he did it after the battle.
Oh, okay.
Or some argue during. Which that may not seat well for most of you.
No.
Because they think, well, how could you do that to an animal that has done you no harm? The horse is just doing its job. It's been trained to do this. Why would God command this? Because the Torah actually gives you indication to precisely not do this. You wouldn't normally do this. You would not normally harm an animal for any reason, unless it is either A, causing you physical harm, B, has killed or injured some other human being, or you're eating it for food or sacrifice. Those are normal conditions. This is actually a rare occurrence that God says, you're going to do something different to these particular animals. It may not sit well with you. We'll discuss a little bit more as time goes on, but keep in mind, this is God, and He makes a choice for a reason, and it gives you a little bit of hint in Deuteronomy as to why He did this. Yeah, they weren't just any horses, as Gary just points out. They were chariot horses. See, in the book of Deuteronomy, God clearly points out He does not want you, the people of Israel, to produce horses to ride and control chariots. He actually tells them not to do so. He says, mind you, your kings will. They will do precisely this, but I don't want you to do it. There's something about chariots in particular that God does not care for, does not like, which we'll get into that as time goes on. Any other questions or comments? Yes?
That must go along well with the verse that says, some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will trust in the name of the Lord.
Precisely. That is the reason it is given. It is to not trust in your arms to save you, but to trust in your weapons to save you, to trust in God to save you. That's the reason it's given to not do this. Now, mind you, the Israelites didn't use chariots all the way up until David. David used chariots. He didn't use a large number of them, but he did use a few. That's documented, it points out in, I think it's 2 Samuel. He takes over an army. Now, Israel is almost exclusively, during their entire history, infantry army. They have bows and arrows and whatnot, but they don't have horsemen who have chariots. David introduces the ability to do so by taking out another army and confiscating its chariots. Now, granted, in his process, he does the same thing Joshua did. Destroyed all the horses, except 100 of them, and kept 100 chariots to go with it. There was a couple thousand that he had confiscated during the battle. So he kept a small select number of them. Again, something God did not want the Israelites, as they were conquering Canaan, to do. Do not trust in chariots. Any other comments or something as we go along here?
So did God tell David not to do it? He did it anyway?
I should read you the section of Deuteronomy as far as how it's worded. I wrote it down here. He points out Deuteronomy chapter 17. Now, this instruction is not given to the kings. It's given about the kings, what they're going to do. And it's in Judaism, they look at this and say, well, it's because it's given to the kings what they're going to do. It's not something that God wants you to do. It's a philosophy of how you look at something. But 17 verse 16. Actually, back up a little bit. Technically, yeah, verse 14. And when you come to the land which the Lord your God has given you and possess it, and dwell in it and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, which is exactly what they did. This is a prophecy in history. You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. But he shall not multiply horses for himself or cause people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Continuing on, gold, silver, still his throne. And he shall write a copy of the book of this law. But there are various rules for kings to do. Now, all the way up till David, they did not have chariots. But David onward, they had chariots and horses. Now we say, well, how could David do this? Well, keep in mind, David may have been a man after God's own heart. The instruction is in the Torah, the law. The prophets and section and stories, those are people. Right, keep a difference here. People may do their best to follow the law. That's the point. They're doing their best to follow the law. They're going to fall short. David had chariots. No, not very many, but he had a few. Take or leave it. That's just the way it is. You know, kings and people don't always do everything ideal. That's just the way life is. So we accept that. And this is a true. These are true stories. These aren't ideally or sanitized to make the Torah work. These are the Torah was given, and then these are all the people, stories who tried to obey in some cases, and in others chose to disobey or failed in doing so. There's nothing else to say about it. That's just the way it is. Any other comments regarding the horses? There's two, by the way, Jewish thoughts regarding the horses, because it does not sit well with people that you would hamstring a horse, cause inflict pain. The other terminology to do this to a horse isn't technically the English word of hamstring. It's a way of gouging a muscle. Basically making the horse unfit for battle. It's still alive, still able to live its life out, but it can no longer be used in actual war. That's another Jewish interpretation of the same word for hamstring. I think they call it, I don't know the exact word off the top of my head, I've forgotten it. But that is a possibility. I will not say that's right or wrong. It's just, that's just another way it could be. Either way, they caused physical pain to this horse to prevent it from riding chariots. Hence, now when you have no horses that can ride chariots, or carry chariots, you don't need chariots anymore, thus Joshua burned them. They're no value anymore. One other thing about the chariots, the Canaanites spent quite a bit of money and time developing chariots. If you had noticed, but one of the cities, one of the areas right off was called Greater Sidon or the Great Sidon. It's a territory area. I have a little city marked here on this little map called Sidon. Well, unfortunately, I put it down here. In reality, it's up here off the map, but I didn't quite draw it to scale to get it on the map. So I've got a little symbolic little token Sidon there. Sidon is a very, very large metropolis city. It's a Phoenician city. Those of you who have heard of Homer's Odyssey, I don't recall that, his little story about, you know, the Trojan or Troy and other stories, whatnot. Sidon's listed there in his story, which predates various days, predates many, many thousands of years ago as far as his story when it's supposed to take place. Obviously, it's a story, it's just a mythical story, but he lists the city. Why? What is so special about this particular town? Do we know the details or recall any history about Sidon? It's not listed in the Bible, but it's world history. Sidon had a unique talent. The city itself had developed the ability to master glass and to work glass to make objects, what we would call, we use it all over the place. We have glass everywhere there is, windows, everything else. We use glass today. Well, Sidon mastered that ability. They also mastered one other very unique ability that these kings utilized in their chariots. They mastered the ability to make very durable, sharp steel tools, or iron tools. Not just any iron tool. You've heard the Japanese, the folding of the metal over and over and over and over again. Well, Sidon was a little bit earlier than that, not quite as well advanced, but the same philosophy applied. And they attached these tools to their chariots. these weapons on their wheels, which we've seen in the old Ben-Hur movies and whatnot, various other movies. You see all these spikes. Well, yes, they've been around a long time. Hence why chariots were so feared. Because if you have an army of Israel, which is nothing but infantrymen, and you have these horses and chariots that are going to be coming at you with these huge steel or metal, so I can't hold steel, they're actually iron, spikes or tools at their wheels that can cut you down quite easily, it's a very fearful thing. I mean, all of us would fear that. Because all I have is a little sword or whatever, I'm going out there with my sword. Hence, God told Joshua, don't fear. There's a reason he told him don't fear, because this is a fearful thing that you're coming up against. They have not come up against chariots in this manner until now.
Were they
yes.
in the land of the Philistines?
No, this is a little further north. Phoenicians is more accurate, a closer territory okay. in this location. Note my little map here, this little boat that I drew earlier. It's on the Sea of Kinneret or Galilee. We would know the term Galilee or Sea of Lake Kinneret. The Dead Sea is way down here. This little small little lake above there, Hazor, which is one of the cities listed. They travel, basically, Phoenician territory consists of this little nub in the land all the way further north.
So it's like Lebanon today?
Yes, essentially. Yeah, because this Tyre is here, and Lebanon's somewhere in this general area, actually a little further north. It's basically most of these towns, most of these cities and kings that are listed are actually Phoenician towns and cities and kings. That's the physical territory. I'll get into why I'm telling you that in a minute. So we have Hazor, which was not Phoenician, by the way. It is a temple. It's a very huge, major pagan temple, the city is. And you have, Tapu is down there, Dor, which is on the west coast, and you have various Canaanites and whatnot in this general area, which is primarily a mountainous region.
So is Tapu kind of like in the area that ended up being like Samaria?
It's part of the very bottom tip of it. In that general section along here, it's kind of this little map, which includes part of the sea as well. That's primarily Samaria, that's probably primarily Samaria as well. Tapu I wrote down there because it's one of the further south towns of the northern kingdoms. As I mentioned last week, we had a scenario that Joshua and all his people came up against five kings. One day, he extended the day an extra anywhere from 20 to 24 hours because the sun being stayed in place. And all the five kings came together, desiring to attack Gibeon, but he came upon them anyway and attacked them from either, you want to argue, right, left, back, behind, whatever. He came up and attacked them anyway. He defeated all five kings. As I mentioned, it was a different strategy than what the Canaanite cities and towns had employed. Day before, as I mentioned before, Jericho, defense only. Ai, which was offense only. And then you have these five kings, which was a large offense only. And I also mentioned Makeda, which was a leave-me-alone strategy. None of them worked. Well, the northern kings took the five-king philosophy and just expanded it. It's been debated as far as how many kings and cities and towns were involved here. But the area up north is somewhere upwards of 15 to 20 different towns involved in this particular battle. It's a very large number of military men. They tried a larger strategy. Well, if we're too big for them to fight, and we're too overpowering, then we can win if we can defend our territory. Because, of course, they all knew the same story that everybody else knew. The Habiru, as you may call him, or the Joshua and all of his Israelite people were coming to wipe out all of Canaan. So they have a defense issue. We gotta make sure we don't get wiped out. They all get together to join and try to get forces together, of course, as it mentions in Joshua. I think it's verse 4 or 5. Okay, no, I think that's verse 6. 6 or 7. That Joshua came in there so suddenly. They were not expecting a surprise attack. Thus, they all lost. Kudos for Joshua. I want to focus on a few comments here. Get my little note packet out here. Okay, I told you before, Hazor, Jabin, king of Hazor, is a temple town. 10 years ago? 15 years? Something like that. Actually, it's been 1980s. It was about 20 years ago. Wow, that's a long time. they did a few series of archaeological digs, which I like to bring this up because it's just interesting information. They found Hazor for the location. They kind of knew where it was, but it's one of the biggest archaeological digs in the entire Israel as far as its physical size and the area of land it consumes. They found it, and they said, all right, let's start digging. So they started to dig holes, started to dig up territory and dig up things, and they found interesting items. They found a large amount of ash, so many thousands of years ago. Hence, Hazor was burned to the ground. Actually, burned to the ground twice. So, which ash it was, who really knows? Either way, they found ash. It was burned. Under the ash, however, they found big pillars. It said 1.8 meters, so I guess it's about 5, 6 feet diameter across a certain size. Two really large ones. And they also had, by the way, for those of you unaware, letters. Today we use paper and pen, and we think, oh, well, they used rock and chisel. No, they didn't use rock. They used clay. They're human beings like we are, too. They think things out a little more clearly. They don't use rock and chisel. They use clay and a sharp knife, and you can write letters on clays and sharp knives. And they discuss not Joshua's battle, but these letters they found, clay tablets with letters on them, discussing various activity in life at that time. And discuss Jabin, the king of Hazor, that he's writing a letter to another person who's in somewhere other territory, Mesopotamia. It's just an interesting fact that they existed. Now, what they did find is that because these pillars were so large, and the location, and some of these tablets they found this actually a very large temple site. Hazor was originally a city or a center of religious activity, back all the way from Abraham's time, straight through Joshua's time. It was a religious area. That's almost 600 years, something like that, of time cycle that people went there to worship whatever god they choose to worship. One of the reasons, in my opinion, why Hazor was burned. Unlike the other towns, which were not temple towns, there was no religious association with them. Now, of course, they all have various, temples in them, but nothing quite like Hazor did. Hazor was burned, destroyed to where it was uninhabitable for a period of time. It was inhabited again many years later, but I think that's the reason, in my opinion, is because it was a religious center, to not bring that religion into your life. The rest of the cities and towns involved here were not burned. Hazor was. I find that fascinating. There's a particular verse I'm going to be focusing on as I come closer to it, because I think it has slight relevance to us today. But just before we get there, all these kings got together at the waters of Merom. Well, we know the waters of Merom as the pools around Megiddo. You've heard of Megiddo, the town of Megiddo, or Armageddon, the valley of Megiddo. They have pools of a large valley sitting right here, pools of water. They were hanging around those waters. This is where this large, massive army was coming together. Now, Josephus argues it was somewhere upwards of 300,000 men. He's been known to exaggerate, so I'm not going to argue what it actually really was. It doesn't really matter. The point is, they had a large number of men grouped up and around Megiddo territory, which is where they were then attacked by Joshua. Came right in and took them out right there. Drove them out to various locations, drove them over to the Burning Lake, which I think is funny. It's an interesting name, but I won't go into that terminology too closely. They call it, I think the English actually translate it as a brook. But it's actually it's a body of water. Let's see here. What verse is? Yeah, 7. Then they drove them out to the brook of Misrephoth. But I don't know how to pronounce it. Verse 8. It's actually not a brook. It's body of water of burning water, burning lake. It's actually what we would call hot springs But it was a very, very hot area, and it was upwards of closer to Tyre location or territory. I don't know if it exists today, but I like the term Burning Lake. It's just kind of a neat term, so I thought I'd just bring that out. And there are other names, too. If you start translating some of these names, you'll find out some interesting data about who these kings were and what their name means and what their cities' names mean. You can start compiling a little bit of stories in more detail about why some of them were wiped out. I won't go into all of them because most of them are listed in the next chapter, 12, which is next week. So, which we'll get into that as time goes on. It points out that the cities and towns that were left on their mounds, quote unquote, mounds, well, is actually more accurately translated Hebrew word walls, means their walls were still in existence. Means they were not destroyed, so they got inheritance. I mentioned last week, or 2 weeks ago, whatever it was, that if you destroy every town, then there's nothing to inherit. Israelite come in, they destroy some towns, but the ones that are left evacuated, they inherit. Hence fulfilling the promise that God gave back in Deuteronomy. One more point before I move on to my verse I want to focus on is verse 14. The spoils of war. What spoils are they not allowed to take? Do you recall the rule? Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 25. Can't take anything that's been used for a sacrifice of idols or worship of idol worship. So the spoils they can take are other items, cattle, other goods and whatnot. But anything that was used for temple worship or any other worship of that matter, Deuteronomy forbids it. People do not get to take that. If anything, it goes straight into the coffers of God. It goes straight to him. Melt it down. Whatever you wish to do with it doesn't matter, but you do not use it for your own personal uses. Okay, what I want to focus on today. Verse 20. I should back a little bit. Just a little bit. Go to verse 19. So there was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel except the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. All the others they took in battle, for it was of the Lord to harden their hearts that they should come against Israel in battle, that he might utterly destroy them, and that they might receive no mercy, but that he might destroy them as the Lord had commanded Moses. Why would I want to focus on this particular verse? Well, two reasons. First reason I want to focus on this particular verse is that Jewish philosophy states very plainly, if you are going against someone for whatever reason, you have to give them the opportunity to negotiate peace. End of story. There is no choice. You must give the opportunity for peace. If then they opt not to go for peace, then you are to go to battle against them. Two choices. That's how any battle is supposed to work out. It's been around for many thousands of years. The philosophy is not going to change, and it hasn't changed even today. We see that in Israel today.
Right.
Every opportunity for peace is always given. That's the rule. Don't go blanket. You can't just go off on a tangent and just attack them because you know that's the right thing to do. It doesn't work that way. You always have to give peace first. In this scenario, the people of Canaan, were they allowed peace?
Well, you got, I guess if they took Rahab's position, they could have.
Exactly. They still had the opportunity. Mm-hmm. Not as a people, they did have the opportunity, no. But as individuals, they did. Rahab is a prime example. Gibeon, though it was pointed out that they did things underhandedly, still negotiated peace.
Well, you see, but the thing though is that even though it was underhanded, they realized that they were in the less powerful position.
Yes, they did.
And that this ragtag group coming out of the desert was going to wipe them out, even though they looked like they were coming from a position of weakness.
Right. And that is very true. And it was underhanded. It was underhanded for a reason because of what we stated. They knew they were in a position of great disadvantage. These people had God on their side. Gibeons didn't. They had whatever towns and gods they believed in, but that was it. So as my point is, as individuals, any of these people, of any of these towns, can easily have negotiated peace by saying, I'm going to join you. They had that opportunity. Rahab was a prime, very first example of it. The alternative, just leave. Most of the people of Canaanite territory didn't die when the Israelites came in. The vast majority of them moved. The story of Joshua and Judges focuses on the battles and the attacking and going back and forth, back and forth. Well, of course, it's not going to discuss things that doesn't matter to you. It's not going to discuss what happened to Egypt when all these refugees left Canaan and said, we got a place to go. And Egypt had to establish two whole new cities for these people in their southern borders to handle this influx of refugees through Joshua's conquest. The refugees pointed out, even in their own scribes, their own monuments, pointed out, we came here because of Joshua, son of Nun. In their cities, in their pillars, they write this stuff out. Because he destroyed King so-and-so. He destroyed King so-and-so. And all these various kings, we had to leave. So they evacuated. That's the other opportunity for peace. If you're not willing to negotiate peace, leave. The other choice is to war. Now, God hardened these people's hearts in order to go to war. So they would obviously be destroyed, as it says quite clearly, that's exactly what it did. So why is that relevant to us today? I want to bring this out primarily, before this, but this has happened to work so well in today's earlier prayer session regarding the Islamitization of the United States. I want to focus on a concept. If we focus upon ourselves and say, God, please save us, that will give you so far. If, on the other hand, you take a page out of God's book and say, no, God, make these people hard and make them known, you get a different result. If we pray and continue to pray that the Islamitization is made known, that those who are Islamitizing people, whether it's a real word or not, doesn't make a difference, that they are exposed, seen easily identified, who they really are, what their really motives are, quote, harden their hearts. Make them say, I will not conceal what I am. I will confront you, as all of the Canaanite kings did. I will expose myself, which they all did, out in the open, out of their strongholds of cities. I will make myself known and I will confront you. Easier to identify, easier to attack, and easier to get rid of. I'm pointing this out. I like this particular verse because God did it. I'm using it for the case of the Islamitization of the U.S. and various other countries as well. But he did it in this scenario, and it identified kings and individuals who were not willing to make peace, who were willing to go to battle, who were willing to be destroyed by the hand of God. Yes?
That makes me think that is why the Apostle Paul is talking about the revealing of the man of sin, because that finally calls the player out into the field for what he is.
Exactly. Exactly. It exposes, which is, that's exactly what we want. We sit here and we pray, and I pray as equally as everybody else does, that God will stop or slow this process down, the Islamitization of the world, as it has been growing for many, many centuries now. And he has, and there are times when he gives us wonderful mercy. On the other hand, I look at his methodology when it comes to dealing with sin and spreading of it. He exposes it openly and clearly so everyone can see, not just, oh yes, I see Islam, no. See their motives. See their reasoning behind why they do what they choose to do in order to destroy it. That, I think, is an equal item that should also be prayed for. that it should be exposed just as all the Canaanite cities were exposed. Yes, Jeff.
Is there then a connection between the hardening of Pharaoh and the mixed multitude that went out with Israel?
I'd say
yes. I have not looked at that, but yeah, you can say that would be the case.
Because maybe they saw. It was exposed as to...
They saw.
He had every chance.
I mean, the people in Egypt, they saw all these miracles that Moses was doing as well, God was doing. They saw the response of their own Pharaoh. Jeff has a great point. When they can see, when your eyes are opened, you can actually do something about it. Yes.
It's actually very interesting, too, to apply this to what happened with Hitler, and that he rose to power, and then finally it was like somebody got a backbone and stood up to him. But also, the Muslims are now trying to deny the Holocaust. They're trying to make it look like that's not really what happened.
Right, to conceal it.
To conceal it again.
To go back into their strongholds of, well, we can win over time if we keep ourselves quiet. Keep the details of our history and the history of things against not just Christians but Jews as well equal back and forth. That this is something that we do not want exposed. Why do you not want it exposed? Because anybody who sees your nakedness, quote unquote, they can now remove you.
Yeah.
Yes, Jeff.
I was just thinking to what Kerry was saying about the exposing of Hitler, because that was a sentiment that was felt not only by the extremists of the Nazis, but also to a lesser degree, it even continues on today in different parts of the world. Even in the United States, it was even a lot of people who had similar feelings to Hitler as to the cause of the world's ills and such. But Hitler embodied that in its truest, evilest sense, and finally woke people up
to see
what it is.
Yeah.
To the point where, you know, in Germany, it's in Germany they actually have laws against expressing those views. And
right.
A similar thing, I'm just thinking of in South Korea, the Korean War exposed the foolishness of communism and the destructive nature of it. To the point where they have laws where you cannot express any sort of communist sentiments whatsoever.
Which is a fascinating point. That once something is exposed, once it is made known, even those who may have once felt that way, even a little bit, can see what truth is. And say, oh, this really isn't true, is it? I really don't want that, do I? They can make those choices, which is what God wants them to do, wants all of us to do. Say, yes, I see what truth is now. I will then choose to follow that truth. That's why I happen to focus on verse 20. I think it's interesting to note God has not done this just this one time. Yes, he did it to Pharaoh. He actually did it a few other times later on in the prophets as well. To he would hardly draw them out. Bring them exposed in order to destroy them. He'll do it again. Said he's going to do it again. In our future, he's going to do it again. So it's something that we can focus on today. Not just pray, God, slow the process down. Stop it. Reverse it whatever you can. But also expose the process. Not just to me. I can see what I can see. Not just to you. You can see this stuff. But to the whole world who needs to see this. Mm-hmm. To expose it, make it well open and plain to where everybody can see not just who they are, but see their actions, see their motives behind their actions, and where they're going. Yes, Louise.
Quickly, I think about how the devil usually overplays his hand. And number two, Jewish law, number one, must give them every opportunity to make peace. And there was number two. Did you cover that yet?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Did I miss?
Statue.
Mercy. That's the one. Sorry, I did this for the mercy was the other purpose of that.
To show mercy.
To show mercy. think of this. I've done this many, many years ago, probably, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, discussed the concept of mercy. We think, oh, well, okay, yes, this person, I'll give them mercy, but I will not punish them for whatever they did. Well, yes, that is one aspect of mercy, but there's actually a much larger aspect of it. It's once someone, any individual, sees what truth is, you must show them mercy on their past. Just praying that God will slow down the Islamization of the world and expose it isn't the complete solution. Once someone sees, once it's been exposed to them, they may have a past. They may have been associated to it. But when they see and they choose truth, we give mercy to them.
Because they repent.
They repented. Their past is not an issue anymore. Everyone must get the opportunity, just as Rahab did. Dispose of the past, I will now follow truth.
Right.
And that's an important aspect in not Jewish law, but in Jewish philosophy. There's a difference. Jewish law is peace that any opportunity given.
And not to show mercy when it's not warranted. Just to stand
more accurately, to show mercy when it is warranted, not to say to not. It's the same thing, but we're going to get the opposite direction.
Stand back and not to do it ahead of time and let God finish His work, because too many people rush in.
That's the nature of foolish people.
Right.
Any other comments?
It's the nature of the world that we're in, I think.
Yes, it is.
The willingness to be open to the consideration of Islam, for example.
Right.
Where your warning is that they would no longer believe in the lie, but would choose the truth.
Right. Which is what everybody wants.
It came out of Egypt with Israel.
Right.
Yeah.
And many of the rabble, however, happened to want to be destroyed as well during the process of them opting to say, now that I've seen the truth, I don't like the way it turned out. Thus, I want to go back. And God says, no. Yes, Richard.
Wallace Shubat, a person that we know, has gotten the past. He saw the truth out.
Made a change,
and the past now is past. It's not him anymore. He doesn't think that way, he doesn't act that way, he doesn't walk that way.
Well, the Apostle Paul.
Yeah.
He used to crucify.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It actually slayed the old man.
Right.
Yeah. And there is a thought here. You know, when the war first began, Bush extended, sort of getting into the nitty-gritty of current events, where he extended food to the enemy, you know, and people kind of looked back and wondered, what is he doing feeding the enemy? You know, but if he'd have continued that behavior, I mean, we don't know. But that was mercy given to, is that mercy given,
warranted or unwarranted, foolishly or not?
It
could have been. I'm not completely familiar with that story. I had heard about giving food, but I cannot speak to that. I do not have the information that you do.
It was for the people, you know, the
citizens, I'm guessing.
Citizens, not the army, but
that's a separate scenario. That's than the army, because I thought you were referring to giving the army food, which didn't make a lot of sense.
I mean,
citizens and army.
I don't know which is which.
I'm going to call it quits if there are no other comments beyond that. Oh, sorry, one more.
It's just interesting drawing a picture of what you're saying. If you're saying that by God hardening their hearts that they are going to be more confrontational,
right,
then our prayer for exposing them is most likely going to bring on more persecution.
Exactly.
And even inevitably for total exposure, the Antichrist.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's precisely it.
It took the deaths of 6 million Jews plus others to bring Europe and America to the realization of what had been going on under Adolf Hitler, which for 8 years before it happened was slowly growing in Germany. But nobody did anything about it.
Precisely. And I want to point out your comment. Notice what Joshua's response was. Where he's up against something that was fully exposed but very dangerous. What did he do? He trusted in God. God said, don't worry about it. He attacked it as quickly before it got a chance to stand. As fast as he could. To stand. To be ready. Before it got ready. He attacked it. Attacked it quickly. The best he could. He won. God allowed him to win. But it's a process. Again, these are things what I am imploring us all to pray for. Yes, to slow down the Islamization of the world. Yes, to expose it. And as Jewish law, peace at every opportunity, we have to keep that in mind, and mercy when it is warranted. But don't be afraid. Yeah. I mean, any point in time you're afraid, stop a second, start praying because something's wrong. Don't get me wrong, Joshua was fearful. He had fear. Every man does. Especially when you're going against a battle like this. But he did it anyway. He did it quickly. Did not waste, did not spend a moment's notice to think about it. He traveled. Now, go this little map here. I have Gilgal way down here at the bottom corner. Megiddo's way up here. He traveled very quickly to get there. Now, granted, argues that this whole process of conquering the land of Canaan took many years to do. This is not an instantaneous 1 or 2 month process. He took the southern section in a matter of a couple of months, but the northern section, it waited. About 5 years went by before all these kings got together. No, they were all still in Gilgal. This is their campsite. This is where they lived. 5 years go by and then they hear the word. It's time. They've been exposed. Run quickly. Don't be afraid. Go after them. Yes, Jeff, I got to call it quits here after this comment.
I just was thinking of something I heard this week about our brothers and sisters in China. You know, there are always reports of different house churches being under stress and such. And this one pastor of a house church was actually somewhat happy that he got arrested and many of his congregation got arrested. Because, you know, he said in so many words that it just exposed what the empty hearts of those that are coming against him.
Which is the point. Any other questions? No more comments. I'm calling it quits. Thank you for your session. So.